Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee with our head coach, Chad Timmerman.
Hey, everybody.
Our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And back with our special guest, Keegan Swenson.
Hey, guys.
And if we sound a little hoarse, it's because we raced Cross Vegas last night. It was a late night, especially for you, Keegan.
Yeah.
And it was, I'm not surprising, in Las Vegas, it was very dry. It was pretty warm, really windy. And I think we all inhaled our fair share of fertilizer and sand.
Dry grass.
And dry grass. Yeah.
Cigarettes.
Everything. Probably that too. Yeah. It was a fun race, hard as I remember it. It was really difficult. We were talking about it last night. It's kind of like if you're to look at the power profile, the valleys just aren't really low valleys. They're kind of high elevation valleys. You know, it's just you're always putting down power to stay afloat.
Depends on who you are.
We'll get to that. Yeah.
Should we talk? Let's talk about the saga of my bike yesterday, because last time I did not have a seat post.
Yeah, last time we talked about that.
Well, I had the seat post, but so what happened is I forgot a nut. We went to the KS booth at Interbike. The guys were very nice. They had no clue who we were.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
But we just walked up and said, hey, I lost this. And I'm like, please, oh, please. And racing tonight. And he's like, of course. And he reaches into his little bag and gets me one. And
pretty awesome.
Shakes my hand and walk away.
Yep.
Very nice guys.
Bike is all set. Should we go into, in terms of our preparation, we walked around. We walked around almost the whole day all beforehand. Day. And we sat down for a short podcast recording and lunch. But other than that, we were on our feet moving around. Keegan, you were really on your feet because you were running around a
busy morning.
Yeah.
But to be fair, pretty much the most people, at least in the Wheeler and Dealer race, they should be walking around because they're supposed to be there working.
Yes. Yeah. So it should be theoretically.
You know, I don't think it really affected me though, like walking around for the 30 some minute race.
Definitely affected me, I felt like.
So. Yeah, I don't think I would have had a much better race. Excuse me. I don't think I would have had a much better race had I sat all day.
Yeah, I definitely would have. So that said, let's get into really quick. Should we cover the results and then cover data backwards from there?
No, let's go through the story.
Okay, yeah, that's true. There is a story.
Let's do a little
tell.
Teaser, right? So yeah. We got there for the 5:30 race start.
Yeah.
Actually,
before we got there.
Yeah, we're riding our bikes
start
over.
Before that, Nate.
And
don't skip over this detail.
We hopped over one curb, and I dinged my back.
Jonathan and Chad hopped over.
Let me tell the story. You're interrupting me.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
We jumped over one curb, and I nailed my... You guys, we got to start this podcast over again. We jumped over one curb, and I have carbon wheels, and I totally dinged my back wheel, lifted my front wheel up, and then the back one just dunk, and I had low pressure.
Correction. Let's not use dinged, because dinged actually implies that you damaged the actual rim.
Just hit it.
You just clipped the curb with your back wheel. And it was a loud noise.
Yeah, it went through. There was low enough pressure, and I was running 35 PSI on a 37C WTB Riddler. Mm-hmm. And it was enough to hit the rim hard, where I was like, ooh, that's not good.
Yeah.
So we were cutting through some stuff. And then when the next curb we come up, I go, hey, I'm not going to ding my back wheel. And like an NFL player who sees the ball coming and thinks they can get a touchdown and turns and runs before they actually catch the ball, I lifted my front wheel. And then I went to shift my weight forward to lift my back wheel. My front wheel never cleared the curb. So if you would have seen me in the parking lot, I lifted my front wheel and then went down and I leaned forward into the curb and just went right over my handlebars and landed
like a sack of taters, I would say.
My wrists.
Yeah.
So that's you never want to land on your wrists. And then I laid there and
cradling his wrist.
They hurt. They hurt right now.
I thought it broke it.
I thought I was ready to, for about 10 seconds, I was like, I'm not racing. I'm not racing. Then 45 seconds and let's go.
Yeah.
So
that set the scene. Then that bent your derailleur hanger. That also.
You're ruining my story.
Carry on. let's speed it up, Nate.
Okay. Anyways, we're riding and my bike won't shift. And we go to a mechanic and what the mechanic did is he noticed that the rear derailleur is bent. And
hanger, not
the hanger is bent. And when I got into my big chainring, the 42, it would actually fall off into the spokes, my chainring, which is very bad. And so this is the takeaway I want to say is he adjusted the limit screw so that I couldn't get in the 42, which saved me to be able to race. then he tuned it as best he could, kind of in the mid range, which is where I'd be using it most of it. And I actually, the shifting worked well. I wish I would have had the 42, but my bike was ready. Before the race, I had some brake rub, a little bit of squealing. Johnny was just, new pads, just go ride that thing.
Yeah.
Right? So well, that's where the story is right now.
Yeah, I didn't tell you to, you know.
You definitely told me. Didn't you hear him, Chad?
Oh, yeah. But it's not as if, like I said, let's put new pads and rotors on your bike right before a race and go ride it and everything will work out okay.
No.
Let's be clear.
So what happened is in Reno, I was rode my bike and no rub at all. I got to Vegas and there was rub. And we tried to look to adjust in their flat mount, which is a little bit different.
Yeah.
We didn't know what we could do to adjust them.
I think that this is just another example of...
I think this is a lesson we've learned I don't know how many times over, and we tell people not to do this very thing.
So have we learned it? Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, so the difference here, though, is you suspect it's something with the pressure change flying.
Yeah, so...
So if I would have ridden in Reno for 4 months...
You did not, no. So you did not really ride it in Reno. You rode it down in a parking lot versus getting out and actually putting some time on it. So I don't know if there's a situation. You do have SRAM Red calipers mated up to SRAM Force brakes on your bike. And I have no clue if there was air trap somewhere in the system that wasn't revealing itself. But if you're going into severe pressure changes like a plane, if you do have any air in the system, it usually manifests itself. So this could be a situation where air got trapped somewhere and it actually closed down your brakes a little more.
This is air he would have worked out of those lines had he ridden for a couple months?
Yeah, exactly. Just with the jarring, the normal process of riding, you can get it out. And then you'd know, hey, I have to do a bleed, and you would bleed it, and that's how it goes.
I see. So this is what I experienced. Right before I pack my bike, spin both wheels, no brake rub at all. Yeah. When I unpack my bike, spin both wheels, tons of brake rub.
One of the brakes have gotten touched as well. Levers. All exactly. It takes is like one little bump the lever, then the pads are going to squeeze, and then you have to.
That's
like
probably what's going on. Everything. Is they something like that.
A pro tip before you put on your wheels. I feel like this is something I should have told you before, Nate. When you unpack your bike and you have disc brakes like that, something that I do is I just take in like a flathead screwdriver and I just carefully wedge them back out a bit.
Aren't there clips that you can buy? Aren't there clips I can buy that I can put those in when I...
You can.
I should
get or cardboard some. Also works.
Yes. That's probably
they come with all the Wahoo kickers, those little tabs.
Yeah, and all in every pair of SRAM brakes.
Yeah.
Really? So we have them in the office.
We should.
We just didn't use them.
We've got many of them.
Okay, another takeaway. I'm glad I can help. The other one that was bad is normally, so that we unpack the bike a day early, but I didn't ride it because we didn't have a seat post, or I couldn't put my saddle on.
Yeah.
Right? So, and then we had a late show and we didn't have a lot of time to do.
So lesson, prep your bike beforehand, ride it beforehand before you go into a race.
And that's what we say, like, right for you, to ride at race pace and do some intervals. And if I would have, I think if I just would have ridden around, I think I would have figured it out. Yeah, but it was different, like, it was different when we raced, and that's a different part of the story, but let's continue.
Yeah, so we got decent call-up positions, and Keegan, we're going to get to your race later. You're more exciting, so we save that for later on. We got different call-up positions this year than last year. We were about, so we had 51, 52, 53
we were six for our numbers. Back.
But they called up some people a little beforehand, and that's why we ended up being six rows back. They called up some special folks. I don't know who they were, but they got to go in a little earlier. So we were about 60 riders-ish back, probably around there, 50 to 60, somewhere in there. And I started hard, but I feel like I also was pretty reserved on that first lap. I was making passes where I could, trying to be efficient. And yeah, it was a hard lap in terms of power output, but it was not a situation where I was completely gassed coming across the line for the second lap.
And it was your fastest lap by 10 seconds.
It was, yeah. So, and I think that the reason that it was, so just being further up in the start like this, it makes it a lot easier. After that, it got pretty spread out, at least where I was. And I know, Nate, you mentioned that too. It got pretty spread out. So
just like last year.
Wind was definitely a factor.
Halfway through the lap, it was spread out enough where I could pass people. I mean, it was still the same thing, though, where I think, Keegan, you talked about this, but the best line, you have to go around somebody because the best line is taken.
Yeah, at least where I was, it was so spread out that was not the case. It was the guys that were up there were quick and they were carrying good lines. So when you would pass them, it was usually a mistake or if you expended extra power, something like that maybe. But it's pretty rare that I felt like I was out of options for passing. It was just up to pace. So the wind and drafting and riding, you know, effectively with another group was
key. Drafting was a real concern last night because there was a pretty blocky headwind on the opening stretch, and it kind of manifested in a couple other spots on the course. So there were some spots where it did pay to tuck in behind somebody if you had the option.
Yeah.
So my start was, I actually thought I clipped in fast, and I was like, this is a good start, and I'm going. The problem was, so, you know, we're lined up really close.
Yeah.
And the guy to the right of me, you know, someone in front of us, so that imagine like four riders. There's me, a guy to the next to me, and then there's a guy in front of me and a guy like diagonal to me.
Yeah.
And the guy diagonal to me, he had a very bad start. But the guy next to me had a very good start, and the guy in front of me had a really good start, right? So what happened is after about a second, there was a big gap in front of me.
Yeah.
And the guy next to me, I'm sorry, the guy kitty corner to me had drifted back.
Yeah.
So the guy very next to me, what he decided to do was cut in front of me as hard as he could. And he actually hit my front wheel enough to turn me.
Yeah.
And I totally unclipped. And I was like, had one leg out and kind of the bike falling. And I don't know if that too hit my rotors. I had both brake rubs. I think it's something different.
Yeah.
But anyways, that was enough to knock me down. And you just get swamped. I'm like, don't get hit.
Yeah.
But that didn't really slow me down that much, because after I started, it got so bunched up that I think I was like two riders behind you guys.
Okay.
So it was, although it was like nerve wracking and annoying, it wasn't enough to slow me down. And I think, what do you guys think? Was that, it was faux pas because he hit me? I don't mind if someone cuts in front of me, but actually hitting my wheel.
Starts are messy.
Right. Yeah.
Is that just the way it is?
Yeah.
What?
I think it's fair game. I mean, he didn't intentionally hit your wheel. He just saw the hole that you should have filled the hole and he went for it.
Okay.
Yeah. So I guess it's fair game.
Yeah. Especially in a sport like cross, even like mountain biking. I know in road riding, everyone loses their mind if you bump another person, even though they shouldn't. We've gone over this a lot. But in cross and mountain biking, elbows are good. Like, it's just fine. It's so normal.
If I had an even better, faster start, he couldn't have done it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just got to make sure you fill the hole before someone else does.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about Keegan's start.
Okay.
Because he has a cool strategy. Yeah. So you were 40, super you were the smart. Very last person. Tell us what you did.
Yeah. No UCI cross points meant I got to start in the very, very back. So in that situation, sometimes I think it's better to start like a bike length or two behind the very last row. Because at that point, like, there's no point in jamming your front wheel up in the person in front of you when there's no one behind you. So you might as well start a little ways back and like kind of plan ahead and like try and like get your momentum going before everyone else even really gets clipped in. So you can like blow through a few rows and at least like make some positions up before everyone really gets their momentum going. Hmm. So I think that's a pretty good strategy if you're starting in the very, very back, because at that point, I almost think it's better to start there than it is to be like second to last row.
Yeah. So you basically saw the light turn green and that's when you were in and already rolling.
As opposed to being jammed up in there and not being able to see the light and like not, and just waiting for the person in front of you to go.
Right? Were you doing a track stand?
No, because that's technically illegal. I mean, I guess you kind of could, but it's not.
But you just started back. So the light turned green. The guys in front of you were still clipping in. You were already rolling.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, it's really cool is that Keegan had already built up speed and going by the time that his row just started to move. So by having that gap, like, he had the momentum going, and as they started to pedal, he's going 4 or 5 miles per hour.
Yeah, so totally made the best of worst situation.
And how much did you clear on that?
How many positions did you gain?
I mean, it's really hard to say because everyone's like moving through, but I don't know. I moved up a few spots, like, and at least it's like, you feel like you're safer and you have a little better advantage. I mean, it's really hard to say like exactly how many spots or how many rows, because everything just kind of funnels and gets, you know, stretched out.
Because of that little jump though, did you work through the field a little quicker?
I think so. Yeah. Like, I think it helps, because once you kind of start moving up, you start finding holes better and just like, you know, finding the gaps. So
for clarity's sake, I feel like we should just reiterate, Keegan did not race with us.
Yeah,
as we go back and forth, these are going to be very different races that happen between Keegan and then the rest of us. So something I noticed, Keegan, on your first lap, you made up probably 10 positions at least, and you were already, and that was like, if you look at the course online, you can see it in the long stretch that runs the perimeter of the course in the beginning. Mm-hmm. By the time you got into the S turns, you were already about 10 riders ahead. Do you feel like in that first lap, you burned were you okay with burning a lot of matches? Did you burn a lot of matches, or was it just like you taking better, more efficient lines?
I think it was a bit of both. I mean, you kind of have to burn a few matches to, you know, get to where you kind of want to be racing. Cause if you stay in the back too long, then the field's going to get stretched out and it's going to be harder to make up places as you go. And you're going to have to spend more time in the wind by yourself. And it just, it's not as easy. Mm-hmm. So it's a combination of that and just taking good lines and being smart. Or sometimes you take a bad line faster than someone taking a good line and cut them off.
Right.
And try and move up.
So, and it was windy. That's another thing to say. It was windy.
So you wanted to like try and make as many positions as you could. So then, cause otherwise it started breaking into small groups, mm-hmm. and then to bridge from group to group made it kind of tough in the wind.
Right.
So
did you end up in the first turns, there was a almost, I would call it like a chicane section. It mm-hmm. was like a 90 followed by an immediate 90. So mm-hmm. it really kind of made a 180 out of it. And then you did a 90 in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. Then you ended up dropping through a bunch of different turns. Did you dive inside there? Were you looking for opportunities there or in those tight spots, did you just fall in?
I mean, for the first lap, and there's so many people that it was really hard to like take the right line. It's also, there's not a whole lot of space to pass. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of stayed in the group and did what you can in those first really tight turns.
Yeah.
Try not to crash or get in any trouble.
Something I noticed that in our group, a lot of people saw those turns as an opportunity to dive bomb in and gain a few positions. Mm-hmm. Well, and it pretty much never worked out because they would get pinched off.
Yeah. Cause you just shut them down.
Yeah.
I think in our, like in the pro race, most of the guys understand that like, it's just not worth doing that. Like everyone has to slow down to take this turn. So you might as well just kind of fall in the line and do that. Cause if you try and chop in and cut someone off that bad, they're not gonna give you the line.
Yeah.
So
you can make those things work if you absolutely need to, but in most cases it's not the faster way to do it, especially when you're stuck in a pack of a bunch of riders.
Like pretty risky. And if you cut someone off, then they're gonna come back and give it to you later. Yeah. So
yep. Yeah, absolutely. So that was something interesting. I think a lot of people get overexcited perhaps on the first lap. And they may see, you know, they're thinking in Formula One, I saw Lewis Hamilton dive bomb into a turn, you know, and they think that that's the way to do it and get the turn done. Who knows, you know?
That actually, so and, to me, someone cut me off on one of the tight ones. And then the next time I positioned myself so I couldn't be cut off.
Yeah.
Which nice. Is like, was probably the smarter way to race. I should force them to go around me and take the bad line. And I didn't leave much room the first time,
right?
But it was enough room for a person to be like, that, mm-hmm. that's enough to, you know, come by.
Right after that section, we had the first obstacle that we encountered, which mm-hmm. was a set of sand stairs. There were three stairs. They're probably about 6 inches tall and maybe a little less.
Yeah. Give or take 4 to 6.
Yeah. 4 to 6
inches. Sand on the backside.
Yeah. Sand on the backside, three of them. And in pre-riding, I rode them. It was just fine. And I feel like that was a lot faster because you had a long run up after that.
Mm-hmm. But it was a lot faster.
Yeah. What did you end up doing in that section?
The first lap, I ran it just because there was a lot of people in the chaos. Way and it was kind of chaos. Then the rest of the race, I rode them.
Yeah.
You could carry in a lot of speed and then you can carry more speed afterwards. And there was one lap where I kind of misshifted and then had to kind of muscle over it, which wasn't very fun. Otherwise, it was pretty smooth. So
yeah, I saw you would just jump like bunny hop completely in on the first one.
And then and pedal hop the rest. Because you kind of have to pedal as you're going up them.
Yeah.
So you just kind of had to like be smooth and be smart not to smash your pedal on the stairs and go over the bars or something. But
so that means you're ratcheting and you're like basically lifting front wheel, rear wheel, front wheel, rear wheel.
Yeah, exactly.
And ratcheting with your pedals while you do that.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Oh, you had to ratchet your pedals? You
could ratcheting pedal? or just mentally kind of timing the pedal stroke so you wouldn't smash into the... Mm.
Yeah.
Because if you did pedal, if your pedal was down at 6 o'clock as you're going over the stair, you wouldn't
hit
catch
that.
Your pedal. So...
Yeah, and once I got into the race, first lap was chaos. I had, you know, I was batting away bikes and wheels and derailleurs mm-hmm. and everything else out of my face. And then once we got into the second lap, I was so cross-eyed that I did not even think of riding them. But I feel like that was a lot faster because of thereafter, it had that kind of long uphill drag. Mm-hmm. And if you were still in your pedals, you could get back up to speed so quickly with less energy cost than running all the way up it. Mm-hmm.
No, yeah, somebody did that to me, like... a lot of people ran it in my spot in the race, but mm-hmm. Somebody who I was faster, I had passed, and then he went and hopped up those and went, put on 5 seconds on me or something. It was way faster.
And the other sections, like the barriers were kind of like 50-50. I think it was almost faster to run them unless you were super smooth hopping them.
Let's cover that. So there was another section with four stairs, and they weren't sandbacked. They were carpet-backed.
Mm-hmm.
And about the same height as the other ones?
Yeah, same height, but it was a steeper pitch. So they were like closer together and... I only saw one guy ride him, and he did it pretty smooth, but it still wasn't necessarily any faster.
It's after a hard right turn, too, so it scrubbed off a lot of speed right at the last second there.
And after the stairs, it was a very short little knoll. Yeah. It was, you didn't have a long drag thereafter, so you could carry some speed up to that thing and through it, and if you were still running and then jumped on your bike, you could carry a lot of speed.
Yeah.
I only saw, so Jeremy Powers rode it last lap for show when he was coming in third. All the leaders, they were running those stairs.
Yeah, anytime I saw, a couple times I saw a guy run it right next to a guy who rode it, and they were dead even all the way up. Yeah. So it just looked more stressful to ride it.
The other thing that was interesting that I didn't know is there were a section where there was two barriers we'd run over, and then you'd do a sharp or a steep uphill with a sharp 180, and all the pros mounted on their bike before they went around the 180 to go back down, and I didn't do that. I would run around it, and so I started to go downhill first and then jump on. And I never, it seems counterintuitive, right, to like jump on your bike going uphill.
But really they're not.
And I was getting on, I think a lot of us were getting on right like the apex of the turn.
Yes.
Rays are coming around the post because that's when you start, that's when you're moving slowest anyway, is turning. So it was like a good opportunity to get on, and then you have time to like clipping your pedals as you're kind of coasting and pedaling down the hill.
I actually learned that from watching the pro race last year. So I didn't apply it during that race, but I did apply it during this race, and it worked beautifully.
Yeah. And it also helps in the sense that this was a left-hand turn, and most people dismount off the, you know, on the non-drive side of their bike. So when you made that turn, it made it very easy to swing your leg around too.
Yeah, so you're kind of like two in one.
Really comfortable, really smooth. It made you feel, even if you sucked at mounting and dismounting, it made you feel like you knew what you were doing for a bit.
It didn't feel fancy. That was the I actually did a really good job getting on and off besides for doing it downhill because I felt like, I'm going really fast and it's kind of weird to jump on your bike going downhill. So yeah, I never knew that.
Yeah.
Guys. It's a podcast about learning stuff. Teach me.
We're competitive too, Nate.
You want to tell me?
The barriers, they were pretty close in succession. I saw some people bunny hop them, but I'm almost certain that it was actually slower to bunny hop them versus running them very well.
Especially with the really fast entry into them.
Yes.
So you could say, I almost thought it was faster to just get off and run through them.
If you carried the,
not quite as cool.
If you just carried your speed through that section, like continued and tried to bunny hop them, they were too close together.
Yeah, you'd smash into the second one real quick.
I think the biggest takeaway is just it's really going to depend on the barrier and the race. There's one size fits all for everyone at home because
not at all.
Yeah. And just because you can bunny hop barriers doesn't necessarily mean that's the best way to go. It's not necessarily the fastest approach.
Yeah, and I want to just recap some quick principles to help you rather than saying it just depends. Some quick principles. If you have an obstacle and afterward it has a long uphill drag, that might be a situation where you consider riding if possible, because then you don't have to remount on an uphill section thereafter.
Mm-hmm. Or run the entire climb.
Right. That said, if it's barriers and they're really close to each other, think about how much speed you'd have to scrub to bunny hop them versus how much speed you could maintain by just running through them. So really the end goal here is to get from point A to point B of the beginning of the section to the end of the section quickest, and also be able to do that safely for the whole race.
At the minimal cost.
And saving energy.
True. Yeah. Yes.
Like I thought there was a few laps once the sand brings us kind of back to the course. There's a big sand pit.
And uphill off camber.
Uphill off camber sand pit with a few hidden bricks.
Yes, and rocks.
And rocks. But the first few laps, it was kind of chaotic and I couldn't ride it. And then once it spread out, it was so much nicer to ride through. You could save so much energy. And it was probably a little bit faster to ride it, but just the amount of energy you save, not having to run through that deep sand and not getting sand in your shoes, because I hate getting sand in my shoes.
Yeah.
Was a lot. It was really nice.
It was dramatic. So. From my viewpoint, I felt like it was dramatically quicker if you rode that than ran it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
We would see massive gaps open up.
And just saving energy was huge.
It was a race for the sand. That's why it was at Steak who got away.
Yeah.
He was the only guy who got to ride it because he got there first. Everyone else, the second rider came off, and that's it.
Even if the guy in front of you is riding it, like it's hard to follow him and ride it because sand moves around, and like sometimes you might get a little too close and touch wheels or like.
Sands,
it's like you either want to like go in front or give the guy ahead of you. Like even if you know he's riding it, like I was following Jonathan Page and I gave him like just a couple bike lengths just to like be safe and make sure.
Yeah.
So even then I still smashed a brick one lap and had to jump off and start running.
We saw one rider, and this was a good thing that they would do because it was a long sand pit. they'd put a lot of power in and they'd make it maybe halfway and then jump off, and they did it smooth.
That worked pretty well. As long as you like anticipate that you're slowing down and you're going to have to get off.
They knew.
The worst is like when you like stop quick and then you have to like kind of hobble off your bike and then you're kind of stomping through the sand.
One key with that, like adding to that, is if you are going to ride partially into the sand, you want to be dismounting long before you get to the point of your speed that you'll be running.
Yeah, so you can keep the momentum going.
Yep, you want to carry more.
So there was one guy that we saw, he went through and he pedaled till he stopped kind of, or he stopped very, very, very fast. And the guy behind him actually hit him and the guy behind him looked so mad.
So mad. And it's kind of like in a sand section like that, if a guy messes up in front of you, like you're following him, getting upset at him isn't really going to do you much.
Although it is frustrating.
Like, it certainly is.
Yeah, it happened to me like a few times and you're like, all you need to do is stay on your bike and ride it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But like, there's a lot going on. He could have hit a brick. He could have hit a rock.
Exactly.
Like, and those things stop you in a hurry, especially when you're expecting to smooth, like granular sand.
It's also worth noting the power output that you would see, at least visually, you would see the amount of power the leader and of the people that were riding it, that they would put out to go through that sand was massive. It was a huge butt. If you're to look at the energy cost of running through, it's probably greater. So, and it's certainly a lot slower.
I'm sure it's greater energy cost, but it gave him the gap. So I think that's a key.
Exactly. Yeah.
Keegan, I think this is I'm not sure, but I want your opinion on this. In cross, especially in the pro race, there were groups, but it seemed like people would make their break on more technical sections. Like this, well, not technical, but like the sand, right? Like people would make their breaks there. And I've had it in my races where maybe like some guy did it to me on the uphill little steps where he could ride them, but I couldn't. Mm-hmm. He put out extra power there to get that gap where I just couldn't respond because I was running, right?
Right.
Does that happen where it's something where you combine technicality with power to get gaps in cross to?
Yeah, yes and no. And it's also just like being in the right place at the right time as far as the sand's concerned. Like if you're, you know, if you know that you can ride the sand and you know that you, like the guys behind you can, or if you get there first, then they're gonna have a hard time riding it. So it's kind of opportunity. And also in this course, the way with how windy it was, that was some of those places were the best place to get away. Mm-hmm. Those and like the steep climbs that were all, because you kind of drop in and out of this bowl. So those steep climbs are also a good place to try and put time into people and try and get away. Mm.
Another aspect that we dealt with in a lot of the corners, especially as the race went on for us, and then Keegan, I'm sure during your race, because after that they had other races that had gone on, it was really blown out. We noticed in the turns, at least at the apex, a lot of the turns, the grass had more or less been scrubbed off, and it was really loose in those spots.
Mm-hmm. It was
slippery.
Because it was like dry grass on top of loose, dry dirt. So it was weird. It almost got dusty.
Yeah.
And it was like really slippery. And you had to like, luckily there was kind of a rut, like kind of starting to form. Like you would slide and kind of drift into the rut and then you just try and hang on through it and not fall out of it.
Yeah.
there was a lot of loose turns out there. It was like, I wasn't really expecting that to be as loose as it was.
You two guys would slide. Yeah. Chad and I are still not comfortable sliding on a cross bike.
No, far from comfortable.
I think that there's a couple of keys to that. Like, and first, of course, like, you know, like bike handling, being in the right position, familiarity with the bike, all that stuff certainly helps. Tires also, you know, if you look at our tires have a pretty round profile. And they also have, like, I guess, less of a gap between the top knobs, which are extremely small on the WTB Riddler, and then the side knobs. And one thing that can be kind of helpful is a slight gap in between those top knobs and the side knobs, right, Keegan?
Yeah, especially in conditions like this, because I felt like sometimes with your guys' tires, maybe you weren't laying the bike over enough to really get onto the side knob. So you were stuck on the drift zone, like, the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like my tires, the Speed Tyrannes were just like a full file tread on top, like ultra slick, and then they had big side knobs. So you would like basically drift, and then you'd instantly hook up as soon as the bike leaned over at all, because there's a pretty square profile, which on this course worked well because you're either leaned over turning or you're going in a straight line. There wasn't a whole lot of like medium type turns, I guess.
You had the better tire for the job then, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. Well, or just, you just learn how to, you yeah, I mean, have to learn how to work with the tire you have.
I just didn't have a lot of confidence on those sides.
Exactly.
You can kind of get used to what you have too. And also maybe a lower pressure might've helped you guys too, because the lower pressure, the tire is going to like deform a little more, and then you're going to get to the side knobs quicker.
And I found, and it's worth saying, like I found those side knobs on ours and it would be just fine. Yeah. It's just, you had to roll a little over a little more than you thought.
And you ran substantially less pressure than I did, right?
Not much.
Probably equivalent as far as your guys' weight's concerned.
Yeah, probably as far as weight. Yeah.
You think it was even? What were you guys, 27?
Your pressures?
Yeah, I was 29 in the back or in the front, and then I was probably 30 in the back. I might have been slightly lower, but I don't think so. Okay.
No, it's 35 and 35.
Yeah, so with our weights, probably about the same.
Okay. Keegan, can you say the name of your tire again?
They're the Maxxis Speed Tyranes, and they were set up tubeless, and I had 27 front and rear. And my tires are 33s. That's a UCI maximum width, mm-hmm. and you guys are all on 37s. So.
Shh, don't say it.
No, it wasn't. It's fine for us.
I know it is. Yeah. I know it is. Yeah. So that is a good tip for cyclocross, is you have to know how your tire is going to behave mm-hmm. on that sort of terrain.
Jonathan, would you have picked a different tire for this race if you could do it again?
After the race, I thought so, but like directly after. In retrospect, if I was to stick with like WTBs like we have on our bikes right now, for no reason other than the fact that we've all had a lot of time on them, I don't think that I would have used a different WTB, maybe gone for something that maybe even less knobs in the center. Because one thing I found this year compared to last year, at least I felt, and once again, we're talking separated by 365 days, right? So take this comparison with a grain of salt, but I felt like I was rolling faster than last year. Last year we ran the WTB Cross Boss. It's got pretty substantial knobs in the center. It's a pretty tight pattern, so it's not like it's a mud tire that's really spread out, but I felt like we rolled really well on this course. Okay. And then in the turns, you just had to deal with some drift, but if you got used to it and then you really got leaned over, you would grab those side knobs and it would hold, but you had to get past that period of drift. So, yeah.
I think, Jonathan, would you have rather had Keegan's tire? I think you could handle it.
Yeah, something like that with even less center. And then, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think so.
But it has bigger side knobs, right?
I think they just look bigger. I think it's a visual thing because I think they're about exactly the same size. I think just because your tire is bigger volume. And also, you actually have a little bit of center tread, whereas I have just a file tread. It's essentially just like hash marks in the tread.
Textured.
It's like texture. So I think it's just a visual thing.
And then what about the gap between the file tread and the side knobs?
Yeah, that's another thing. I mean, like Keegan mentioned, our tires were a more rounded profile versus his has a more squared off profile. That can change based on what rim width you have. That can change on
the wider rim is going to make it a little square. Like I have my stands, the Avions are pretty wide. They're almost the same width as mountain bike wheels. Mm-hmm. So it makes a tire a little more square. Whereas if you had my tires on a narrow, like an 18 or 19 mil rim, for example, the tire is going to have a rounder profile.
Yeah.
So it all really depends on what wheels you have and rims, and there's a lot of factors for tires.
A lot of factors.
Keegan, how often do you change tires based on conditions and the course?
I mean, not a ton for cross. It's kind of like, for me, I guess, racing in the U.S., I mean, it's obviously different racing in Europe, but my cross is just more or less domestic West Coast stuff. And it's either dry or wet. I don't really change tires a whole lot because for me, I think I'll probably use those Speed Tyranes a lot because most cross courses you can get away with a file tread, or maybe I'll put a slightly more aggressive tire up front sometimes if it's super loose dirt and you need to be able to bite through deeper, and then run the file tread in the back, because a lot of crosses, like, it's rolling resistance and re-acceleration, and the faster you can re-accelerate and hold your speed in the turns, the better. So as long as you have a good side knob, you can generally don't need that much tread.
Another thing Keegan said, which is so true on this one, is there's no spots where you really need to hit the brakes. So you don't need that center tread to like slow you down.
You don't need the braking traction.
What?
No, you don't need the braking traction. There's not a whole lot of steep descents or like steep descents into a U-turn or anything like that. So
I found myself in the beginning of the race braking into some of the turns, and I instantly thought, you know what I'm probably doing is pushing too hard into this turn.
You might as well rest a little bit earlier and just coast.
Yep. And just be smooth, right?
Yeah.
Start just
find the right lines. You could set up a little wider so you can pedal through the turn a little more in some of them and just belly it out. So.
And that's one thing that I noticed even last year, getting lapped by Tobin Ortenblad, really fast racer, was the U23 national champ. That's one thing that he was just masterful at, was just smooth all the way through. And if you think about it, if you look at the power profile, mine looks like a magnitude 12 earthquake, right? If you look at my power profile from that race, and if I could smooth that out, I think that I would be more efficient in terms of power output. So that's going to be a big goal for mine going forward. And this course is like a great example of that because of the grass, I feel like.
Which you can take advantage of on any course.
Yes.
Because I think cross is just about holding speed and like being smooth. The less mistakes you make, the faster you're going
to
be.
And we saw exactly that when we looked at our power files compared to Keegan's and our average power compared to our normalized power.
Can we go over that?
We had big spreads. Keegan's was so close to even. It's ridiculous.
Ready for this?
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, it's ridiculous. Let's start with Keegan. Okay. So Keegan, you raced for an hour and 11 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least that's what you turned your Garmin on a little late.
Yeah, I forgot to hit start. So there's probably about 6 minutes of 5 or 6 minutes before I hit start. So.
Of like 800 watts.
yeah, sure.
Nothing big.
Solid.
Just the start.
So your weight's 138, right?
Yeah.
And you did normalized power, 295. Average power, 281.
That's ridiculous.
So it blows my mind that they were so close. And actually, I said, I want that file. Because I was thinking that maybe some software's calculation was wrong. Because it just... I did not believe that they were so close. And based on our racing, it is so far apart.
Right. When you watch those guys, I mean, the lower ranks, we have such a, I mean, our technicality has so much room to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a, we exploit our fitness and we exploit our growing technicality. With the pros, they have such a high proficiency technically that it's really just about fitness. All of them are so even in terms of how well they ride it that it's just the fittest guys. I don't see any guys making big technical mistakes. It's like who's got the power
and you know, like, and where you use the power. It's exactly. Smart is that where you use it and like.
So let me explain normalized power for people who don't really understand it.
Yeah.
Is normalized power is supposed to be like if you would have ridden the course smooth, what it would be. And the way to inflate your normalized power is by doing like really big, hard efforts. And if you do that, the harder they are, the more it will inflate it. So if you have a big difference between normalized power and average power, that means you have really big efforts.
High variability.
Yeah, exactly. And usually then with high efforts, you're going to have rest periods too. No one can go a threshold and high and then threshold and high.
And so, one thing really quick on that, it's normal to see your normalized power be higher than your average power. Because it's taking that into account, right?
And there's coasting inherently, no matter what.
Yeah.
Cycling it's discipline.
So. There's like one math situation that you can get into where AP will be higher than NP, but for real world riding, it's NP is always higher than AP.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. Even if you do a 40K TT, it's probably like 1 or 2 watts higher.
And it usually, and one of the intents behind it is it tries to take into account the higher, I guess, energy cost of those higher efforts, right, that you're putting in. Yeah. So because it's not as if like going from 2 watts to 3 watts is the same as going from 850 watts to 851. Same difference in terms of just 1 watt, but it's harder to get there. Yeah. So that's an interesting concept. So you were really smooth. And what I started with in this podcast where I said the valleys were just not very low. If you're to look at that power profile, it was even more pronounced with you guys in the sense that I noticed you were just constantly on the power and you were very smooth in terms of instead of just coasting, then jamming as hard as you could up a hill, it looked like you guys were really just smooth and carrying momentum.
I think the headwind also might have something to do with that as well, perhaps, because you're putting a little more effort in on the flat straightaway sections where you normally would maybe rest a little bit. So you're trying to keep your speed up. So maybe that has a little bit to do with it.
When you see the lower category riders riding, there's a lot of coasting. I mean, there's a lot of, they just work so hard, I need a break, sort of easing up sort of thing. You guys don't let up.
If you coast for a little bit, you get passed.
Yeah,
exactly. Especially in grass.
Yeah.
It's just so interesting how close that was.
Yeah.
And we're always like, oh, it's cross. There's a big difference. We just ride poorly.
Well, but we should cover it. This course is also unique. It's much more normal to see a bigger difference on a typical cross course.
Mm-hmm.
But this one being 100% grass like that, and not having really like a whole lot of variable or like super, super big, you know, changes in pitch.
But this course, we did the same course. So it's just on this one, it's great see the difference between Keegan's power difference between AP or average power and normalized power and then ours.
The course didn't change at all, which is cool. I mean, I'm sure maybe some lines got a little smoother, but like in general, like it's not like it was muddy for one and not muddy for the other or whatever. So it's like pretty, it's basically as tight as you're going to get.
Yeah.
As far as course conditions.
Yeah. And my point isn't comparing our performance to Keegan's as much as, which we're going to do right now, but just to give people context, this is a smoother power profile course than what you would normally encounter for a cross race.
So Keegan, can I go over placement too?
Please.
Keegan got 16th.
He started 41st.
Yeah. So that's good. He sprinted for 15th, but he didn't realize that he was in 15th because he would have got a UCI point.
Maybe would have found a little. Maybe, Jonathan Page is quick and he's been doing racing cross a long time, so it would have been tight. But I might have maybe tried to find a little more if I knew I was fighting for the last point. But I thought we were fighting for like 16, 17. At that point, it's like,
It doesn't matter. So one thing that's interesting is you're like in the middle of your race, you did many more laps than us, you kind of blew up. We saw it. Like, we were watching you, and we're like, whoa.
You probably heard it, right?
Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah, we could smell the smoke.
Yeah.
But you blew up, and then you actually felt better, and I thought you were actually going to quit, because you look so
I considered
insane.
It. There was a brief moment of, I want this to be over.
Yeah.
So tell us about that. Like, what happened there?
I don't know. Sometimes it just, I think, could have been standing on my feet all day. Like, who knows? I'm not going to make excuses, but just, like, it's, sometimes that's racing, is, you know, you, especially starting hard like that in the back. Sometimes you have to burn more matches than you really want to. And I might have gone a touch too deep. Maybe if I backed it off just 1 or 2%, I wouldn't have exploded in the middle, and I would be able to keep a smoother power throughout the entire race. Mm-hmm. But instead, I exploded, and my laps dropped 30 seconds. I probably lost like 30 seconds a lap for like 2 or 3 laps.
Yeah.
And then I started to come back around, and I had my last 2 laps were like some of the fastest of the,
seconds,
of the day.
Keegan. So let's lost 50 seconds on a lap.
But yeah. Let's cover this though. Your last, on the last 2 laps, you had, comparatively speaking to the other field or to the rest of the field on those laps, you were one of the fastest people on course,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty interesting to see.
I felt like I was working less hard than earlier.
Didn't you have like the second fastest lap time on one mm-hmm. of those? Yeah. So that shows, like, when you think that your race is completely falling apart, especially in cross, because it's so easy to go over that line, maybe it's not. Just soldier through, see what you can do. You might start to feel better. Even in a 4-lap race like I had that. I started to feel more comfortable.
I think it's in every, and almost any discipline too. I mean, you can, even if the race is only 40 minutes long, you can have a great first 15 minutes, and then you might suffer for 2 laps. But I mean, you just got to keep trying, because sometimes things happen and you start to feel good again, and you never know. So
I find that's harder to do with the shorter races though. When it's only a 30, 35,
yeah, even it's harder. You don't have much time to
20 minutes in. There's not a lot of time to reclaim it. But if you have an hour to race and you have a down 10 or 15 minutes even, mm-hmm. then you can kind of get back in there. It's not like you're going to pull back a victory or something, but
Ironman racing.
Yes.
You can be in a deep dark hole, sit in an aid station for like 10 minutes and eat food and be like, I'm fine.
Yeah.
And over if you do like an 11 hour race, 10 minutes is way better than a DNF.
Well, and I mean, in Kona, famously, like, I hear a lot of people that you know, those last 6Ks in the marathon, even without, you know, taking a break at an aid station, they feel absolutely terrible coming into that, and then they're able to work their way through. So,
well, but in a case like this, extending it from 40 minutes to 60 minutes, those guys who hang in there for 40 and are just on the verge of cracking, if they had to go another 20 minutes, that's when I start to claw back spots in those last 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. I pace a little more evenly, or I just have a little more endurance, whatever.
Yeah.
That's when my race starts to take a better shape.
Yeah.
So let's go. Are you ready for Jonathan?
One thing really quick on Keegan's race too. I noticed that a lot of people went hard, but then they like really like cut back mm-hmm. after the first lap or mm-hmm. so. And I noticed them kind of drop back. And then the interesting thing though is they had dropped back. They weren't able to improve their position later on with working harder. They were spread out and away from groups of riders, so they had to work with mm-hmm. the wind alone. And I noticed a lot of people that I thought were going to do better just get shelled because of bad pacing. Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting that you probably could have paced better, but at the same time, you were able to rally back and keep it going. So favoring position, like sometimes if you can't pace things effectively, you're probably going to blow up regardless. But if you can, you know, favor that position and you're constantly balancing those two things. But I feel like you actually did that pretty well with balancing mm-hmm. those two.
I mean, it's always like a fine line starting the very back. Like, you got to get up to the front. Otherwise it gets too spread out. Then you're never going to make it to the top 20 or whatever your goal is at that point. It's done. So maybe I could have not jumped to that chase group right away. Maybe I should have waited a couple laps and slowly moved up. It's like, you know, in the moment, sometimes you get caught up in things and it's hard to make decisions, especially on that grass course. Like, I'm not a big guy, so like plowing through grass is not my forte.
Yeah.
So like, you have to kind of be smart about how you use your effort and.
Yeah, you know. No doubt.
Okay, so for Jonathan.
Yes, which we should cover. We did a shorter race.
We did, much shorter, only 4 laps. Yeah. And 35 minutes for Jonathan.
Yes.
Last year you were top 31st.
Top 31, yes.
And then this year you were top 23rd.
23rd, there
That's
we are.
That's good. Yeah. Improvement.
Yeah, okay, well, there were less people this year. We should cover that too.
No, we shouldn't.
As a percentage, I think
sorry,
we all pretty
much came didn't class. Say that. Ignore. Yeah.
So what's your weight?
147 pounds.
147. And, you know, Keegan's normalized power for almost twice the length was 295, and yours was 2:46.
Yeah.
Shows the difference between age grouper and a pro, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's why you're not second in the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
yeah. And then your average power was 212. So yeah. 212 to 246, yeah. that's a much bigger gap than Keegan had, just to re-illustrate that point.
Yep, exactly.
And you did well. You had a good race.
It was okay. I think I know it's only four laps, but I had a pretty dark period there. I guess you'd say around like minute like 15. And then like lap two and three, they kind of overlapped there. It was pretty dark. And then I was able to kind of start to feel normal again. And I almost felt like if the race kept going a little more, I'd be able to really claw back some positions because I saw a lot of people coming into sight. But I didn't do it.
You know, I think you could have done better.
What's that?
Not have gotten a concussion and taken 6 weeks off.
Yeah. I can't change it. Yeah, maybe. one thing that I feel like I really could have done better was there was a guy on a single speed and he beat me. And I know that's painful, but he was on a single speed. And this course wasn't actually, we were talking about this with Keegan and I, where it probably wasn't too bad for a single speed because, like we said, it's like so consistent.
Yeah, I mean, the climbs would have been tough, some of those really steep ones. Right. But like, and there wasn't, especially with the headwind, there wasn't really a lot of very fast straightaways.
There wasn't.
And the grass is slow in general. So like, I mean, a single speed wouldn't be awful.
Right. I've tried to follow his pace in a few spots and on the climbs, it was really high, right? But then he was coasting in some of the descents where you kind of needed to coast and he was able to recover. Mm-hmm. So, but I tried to follow his speed and we were ripping through the pack pretty well. And it ended up blowing me up. So once again, it was a situation where I thought I can draft off this guy, but then he's on a single speed. What was I thinking? I shouldn't be drafting off him in a section like that. I should be, you know, passing him. So, which I would go to the front, I would pass him and I would pull away for a while and then he'd reel me back. And anyways, I got lulled into a pace that I couldn't sustain and I should have been more cognizant of that.
It's just one big learning process.
Always.
Always, right? So let's talk about the real race. The race everyone's concerned about or interested in. Chad Timmerman.
The only one that matters.
Yeah.
Versus Nate Pearson, yeah. Before we get into that, I'm going to just tease a little more. Warm up. We talked about...
Oh, yeah.
The race was 5:30. That's what we thought. We got there, warmed up, you ready for 5:30. Then over the announcement, Jonathan and I hear, 6:30, Wheelers and Dealers race. So we got an... We were all warmed up. Yeah. And then we had another hour. Yeah.
But it wasn't, I didn't put in any like seriously solid effort or hard efforts just before then.
Oh, so, I did.
Okay. Well, I didn't feel like I had like emptied a tank or anything like that. It was pretty just easy pedaling around. And for a 30-minute race, a longer warm-up isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Well, that's what I want to talk about is so they had like a little practice area and I did that. And then I, after I did those hard efforts, I went on to the Feedback Sports. They had the little trainer set up.
Omniums.
Yep. And I did like, I think 30 to 40 minutes of like easy pedaling. Then I did some like high cadence drills. Uh-huh. And then I got off and then I did a pre-warm-up, like a hot lap. Like I was thinking what Keegan said, wasn't race pace, but I definitely wanted to get some...
Feel for the corners and...
Yeah. And I wanted to do also go hard up the steep stuff, go as hard as I could. Well, not as hard as I could, but I wanted to like open up my legs. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I really, that was the best warm up I've ever had for a race. And I.
That's too bad. Mm-hmm. You're saying for the 5:30 start?
No.
Oh,
for the 6:30, like the extra long warm up. Like it was really good. And I'm going to try to do that again. I felt great during the race.
Yeah.
And two, I want to say my crash did not affect my performance. I can't quantify how much the brakes were, but as I was going through the race, my front brake was humming so loud. It was like a woo, 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 woo. And people on the sidelines would go, whoa, his brake's rubbing. Oh my God, his brake's rubbing. I think my back brake was rubbing. You can tell after you took it off. So the front brake made a lot of noise, but I don't know how many watts it was doing because it was just slightly rubbing. The back brake though, the wheel doesn't go around all the way. And I couldn't shift. But anyways, I mean, the shifting wasn't...
I don't think it affected you.
It didn't affect me. So anyways, I want to say that besides some brake rubbing, I don't have any excuses. Yeah. My only excuse is...
I don't have any excuses.
No, this is an excuse. This is just I am not as good a bike handler as Chad. So we're going through the race, and I had that bad start, but I was behind Chad. He couldn't see me, or maybe you could hear me. I don't know. No. But I was right behind you, and the technical sections... he would pull away. Then the power sections that would kind of come back. And then there was like a S-turn section that was kind of longer. And man, he gained so much time on me every lap, like 5 seconds. And he would just pull away from me and pull away from me. Getting on and off the bike, I don't think he gained any speed. And I did a good job there. But I just want to like drive home how important it is to have good handling and cross as we go over these power numbers. Because Chad and I, same weight, similar bikes. Mm-hmm. So Chad did normalized power 261, average power 218, and I did normalized power 283, average power 237. Mm-hmm. So the difference between AP and NP, very close, but I put out 20 more watts than him, and he beat me by 30 seconds.
And I think I've got 5 pounds on you too. So
oh, do you?
Yeah. So it's just a testament to how it's not just... So you got to have power and technicality.
Chad got top 46, and I got top 51. So that's way better than 117th.
This is. And it's way better. You looked a lot better on the bike, too. I told you that you did not look like a fish out of water. You actually looked like a cross rider going up some stairs, which was cool.
Nice.
I feel like we've kicked off cross season in a better spot than we were last year for us.
Way better.
Mm-hmm.
Way better.
And I feel like... Keegan, you are just taking cross as it comes this year. It's not necessarily like a big like goal for you, right?
Yeah, just something to keep me busy in the off season and have some fun and stay fit, give you some goals.
So why do you want UCI points then for cyclocross?
Well, I'm thinking about going to Nationals. It's not a for sure thing. Since it's in Reno, it'd be kind of fun to go do it. And
So is that if you get some points, you'll do it? If you don't, you won't?
Not necessarily.
You have to have a point. Oh.
Like you can petition in if you don't have points, but obviously then your call up isn't as good. And
so no UCI points, no Nationals.
Oh yeah. We'll see. I mean you can still get in. You just have to petition.
Okay.
I think I'm not 100% sure, but if you have points, then you can for sure get in.
I see.
One thing that Jonathan said about a better start, like last year at this race, my normalized power was 230 and this year it was 83, 84. What I just said, that is big, right? And the course was very similar. But I just want to reiterate this one more time is that Chad and I, you punched it out of the corners, right? Mm-hmm. Keegan was smooth. We could tell that based on the power. Yeah. So I think I slowed down too much and then just hit it hard.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, so
our peaks and valleys were quite a bit higher and lower than Keegan's.
Yeah. Certainly were. Any parting thoughts, gentlemen?
I think so.
We've got a plane to catch. Let's head out of here. Okay. You can submit your questions to trainerroad.com/podcast for the next episode. We'll comb through them and give you some answers and hopefully some context around them as well. Thanks for listening, everybody. Talk to you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
See ya.